Hello, you're listening to a podcast recorded live at the 2017 Sydney Writers Festival.
Welcome, one and all, Friday afternoon, 3 o'clock. I'm sure you all know these distinguished gentlemen, one with a beard, Tim Flannery, Carl Krasinitsky. You may not know me. My name is Nick Rowley. I currently teach at the University of Sydney. I should say thank you to the University of Sydney for paying my salary. In a previous life, I have worked on the global climate problem and a number of other things. For 2 years, I worked at the centre of the British government at Downing Street, advising then Prime Minister Tony Blair on sustainability and climate change, and was part of helping initiate the Stern Review into the economics of climate change. Can you please all put your phones on silent or turn them off? I would like to thank the Bupa Foundation for sponsoring this session. And I just want to say a few things about how I want to run the hour that we have. Firstly, something I share with my students at Sydney University. Karl Popper, the eminent philosopher, Viennese philosopher who actually spent a fair bit of time in New Zealand, he talked about the only excuse, not the only reason, but the only excuse for a lecture is for you to challenge yourselves, for us to challenge the people who are going to be sharing their thoughts with us, and for us to challenge the manner in which we think about the content, because I'm sure you all will have some measure of knowledge and understanding in relation to the global climate problem. I also want to make a point of celebrating you. We don't have writers' festivals unless we have readers, and I'm sure many of you write, but I think we should also celebrate the fact that you all read, and that is something that I think we should all acknowledge. But my first challenge, in the spirit of Popper, to both of these men, who don't really need to be described, I think you know enough about them and their contribution on this issue. My first challenge to them is to ask them a very simple question. You may have thought about this question yourself. What I want to know from each of them, and I want to know it from Carl first, is what is your favourite Beatles song and why?
Strawberry Fields. Out of the Acid was real good.
Tim?
Well, I've just completed writing a book on kelp and how wonderful it is, and I was listening to a few old Beatles songs. What popped up at kelp? I need somebody. And I thought, we need kelp, that's for sure. So that's it at the moment.
Gee, I tell you, I gave them their homework. They thought about it before they shared it with you. So let me just talk about how I want to use the time here, because I want to make sure that there is ample time for you to question our writers and our esteemed gentlemen sitting before us. I bought a brand new call bell. I've not used it before. I use them in lectures because it's very easy to talk and talk and talk on subjects, certainly on complex subjects like the global climate problem. So look, brand new. It's a call bell.
Does it work?
I don't know. We'll find out. But I've asked each of our writers to speak for 5 minutes. No more. At 4.5 minutes, I will stand up and I will make my way towards the bell. They will know that it is time to start wrapping up, and at 5 minutes, I will hit the bell should I need to.
Wow. Wrapping up. I didn't know we had to speak in rhyme.
The first five minutes from each gentleman, and I'm going to go to Tim first, but the first 5 minutes from each gentleman will focus on this task. And the task I ask from both first Tim and then Carl is, what are the three things that everyone, you at the back, you there, you at the back over there, and you down at the front here, what are the three things that we all need to know and understand about climate change? Not the 16 things, not the 7, the 3 things from each of them. My bet is we'll probably get six things. We might get three things. Somewhere between three and six things. We're going to get 5 minutes from each on that. Then there's going to be a little bit of a break. I think we can recognise we probably have a problem. Then I'm going to ask them a very specific question. They can speak for 5 minutes on that as well. That question is going to be, what should Australia, not the world, not us individually, Australia do to minimise the risk of the problem? Once we've finished doing that, it's over to you. Question, interrogate, challenge. Tim, 5 minutes.
Well, Nick, the three things we need to know about climate change are these. It's human-caused, it's a big problem, and we don't have all of the tools we now need to solve it. And I'll unpack that a bit. Climate change is human-caused. The evidence is very clear on that. You know, we can measure the emissions. We know where they're coming from. We've known since John Tyndall in 1859 demonstrated the warming potential of CO2, how the mechanism works. And so there is no doubt that it is us that's causing the problem. In some ways, that's good news. It means that we can solve the problem we've caused. Of course, there's always been climate change in the past. It's just that we are now forcing the climate system at a rate about 170 times faster than geological forces have changed the climate in the past. So very important to know. Secondly, it's a really big problem. At the moment, we are emitting something on the order of 50 gigatons of CO2 per year into the atmosphere. And the atmosphere is quite a finite organ of the planet. If you know anything about the way the Earth system works, you know, the oceans are 500 times larger than the atmosphere. So it's a small organ of a planet we're pumping 50 gigatons of carbon into. Now, how much is 50 gigatons? Well, there's about 7.4 billion human beings on the planet, and how many of us would we need to vaporise to put into the atmosphere to make 7.4 gigatons? Fair question. Turns out we'd need to vaporise us all twice over to put that amount of CO2 into the atmosphere every year. Another way of looking at it is to say, well, what would we need to do to pull out one-tenth of that stream of pollution from the atmosphere by doing something we all understand, like planting trees? So how many trees would you need to plant to take 5 gigatons out? You would need to cover a continent the size of Australia in forest and keep that forest growing healthily for 50 years in order, on average, to have drawn, you know, maybe 4 gigatons, if you're lucky, out of the atmosphere. But we'll call it 5 for round figures. So it's a very big problem. Thankfully, over the last 3 years, we've seen the scale of the problem stabilised. It was growing every year up until 2013. The economy's kept growing, but the emissions have stalled. And that means that we've now decoupled economic growth from emissions growth, from pollution growth. That's very good news. But it's still at 50 gigatons. We need to start getting it down the other side pretty quickly. So it's a very big problem. The third and concerning issue is that we don't have all the tools we need to deal with the problem. When the Copenhagen meeting was held, we did have all the tools we needed to deal with the problem. The fact is the problem's a lot bigger now than it was then. You know, if you look at the history of addressing climate change, if we'd started after the Rio Earth Summit in 1992, when George Bush Sr. said, we've got a problem, we've got to fix it, you know, if we'd started then, we would have had the easiest of glide paths down to a sustainable level of CO2 pollution. It would have been a cakewalk, you know. If we'd started after Copenhagen in 2009, we could still have solved the problem just by cutting emissions. So just moving from old polluting industries to new clean industries. But the problem has grown at nearly 50 gigatons a year now over the last decade, between 45 and 50, and it is now so big that no matter how hard we cut emissions now, there is no feasible pathway back down to below 2 degrees of warming just by cutting emissions. And that is partly due to the very large scale of the CO2 in the atmosphere. It's also due to the fact that Earth's system is changing and the carbon sinks, the things that used to draw CO2 out of the atmosphere, are faltering. So the land sink and the ocean sink are both weakening in their capacity to draw CO2 out of the atmosphere. The other thing that's happened is that finally China is starting to clean up its air quality. And as that happens, more warming potential is released. So we are now committed to 2 degrees without new tools. So my recent book, Atmosphere of Hope, is all about those new tools. Kelp is really important. It's one of the few that offers us the scale. Seaweed farming offers us a scale whereby we can capture CO2 out of the atmosphere and sink it into the depths of the ocean and therefore draw a lot of CO2 out of the atmosphere. If we could plant 9% of the world's oceans with kelp, we could offset all of our current emissions. We could sink them all 50 gigatons of them. I thought that was great news when I heard it, but then I thought, you know, how big is 9% of the world's oceans? 4.5 times the size of Australia, Nick. We've got to have a seaweed farm the size of Asia in the Central Pacific to do that. Nevertheless, it is one of the tools we can use. Carbon-negative concrete, silicate rocks, many, many other tools will get us there in time if we start R&D now.
Well done. Nailed it.
I'm trying to keep the bell virginal. I don't want it tarnished.
David Mackay, the former chief scientist to the Department of Energy and Climate Change in the UK, sadly no longer with us, in reflecting on the nature of the debate with regard to climate change, says we need less rhetoric, we need more numbers. For those interested in numbers, that was 4 minutes, 58 seconds, 0.47. So we don't have terribly much wiggle room for Carl to do a better job.
58,
however, 47. However, I'm asking him the very, very same question. Give me your three things, Carl.
Okay, start the button going. Here we go. And we're rolling. Okay, the three things are the climate has always changed. Number two, we're causing this one. Number three, it's going to get bad and expensive. Okay, firstly, the climate has always changed. 2 billion years ago was one of the worst ecological disasters in the history of the planet when photosynthesis got invented and we had the oxygenation event and the atmosphere changed from this lovely methane to this corrosive toxic poison called oxygen. And as a result, various things happened. Things died out, mitochondria jumped into our cells, ATP, don't worry about it. On a closer scale, roughly every 150 million years, we have an ice age event. So we're in one now, and there's another one 150 million years ago, roughly 300, roughly 400, roughly 600. 600 million years ago, snowball Earth, virtually wall to wall, pole to pole, ice on the oceans. That cycle was broken by carbon dioxide being emitted. So I'm just trying to get you in the mind frame that, yes, the climate does always change. More recently, let's just shrink down to the current ice age event that we're in now. I think it was about 42 million years ago we began to have ice arising in the Antarctic, but the ice ages themselves, which we're in now, started about 3 million years ago. They're related to the Milankovitch cycle, Milankovitch, Serbian astronomer, 1920s. So three things change with regard to how to cause changes in how much sunlight falls on different parts of the planet. Number one, the Earth's orbit goes from sort of circular to elliptical, exaggerating, and then back to, so circular, elliptical, 100,000-year cycle. Secondly, the tilt of the Earth, 23.5 degrees. Cycle slowly between 21.5 and 24.5 roughly on about a 42,000 year cycle, tilt up and down. And then thirdly, as the Earth is going around the Sun, that thing spins slowly like a spinning top once every 23,000 years or so. So when you look at the ice ages, you can see these numbers reflected. From 3 million years ago to 2 million years ago, you had the ice ages happening for about 42,000 years, then a non-ice age of about 10 or so. Ice age, ice 1 kilometre thick over New York and Germany, and the ocean level drops by 100 or so metres because the ice is so thick all across the world. And so then from 2 million years ago to the present, it flipped over to 100,000 years of ice age, about 15, 20,000 years of non-ice age. We're in one of those now. We're in the non-ice age. We were going to go into an ice age in a couple of thousand years. Now we're not going to go into it. So firstly, the climate has always changed. Secondly, I first got interested in this in the mid-70s. when I had read in New Scientist that Munich Re, the world's largest reinsurance company, was now factoring climate change into its insurance premiums. 1973. 1980, I did my first story saying there's this thing called global warming might be real, might not be real. 1985, I said, gee, we still don't know for sure, but the insurance companies are sure, but the scientists are not. 1988, the scientists said we're locked in. As real. So we've known for over a quarter of a century that it is actually happening. The press were okay with it for about a year or two, 89, 90. I actually wrote for a Murdoch paper, an eight-page spread on climate change, which I still have in my office. 1 year later, they flipped over into, it's not real. The fossil fuel companies had a choice. We'll do something about it or pretend it doesn't happen. We'll cover it up. So climate change has always happened. We've caused this one. And then finally, it's going to get bad or expensive? Yes. You mentioned 2 degrees. What's the big deal? 2 degrees. Changes more than that between midnight and midday, yes. But an average of 2 degrees means that the polar ice, the ice caps, the global ice is no longer stable, and we're already seeing 600 billion tonnes a year melting. That's what 2 degrees means. Well, that's actually 1 degree. It'll increase and ramp up the curve. There's a little creature. Can you turn it around so I can try and beat Tim's record there? So there's a creature called the pteropod. And you think, what the hell is a pteropod? It's about this big. And if you think about carbon atoms going around, I eat some corn, I breathe it out as carbon dioxide. It goes into a tomato plant, I breathe it in, it goes out, goes around the world. Of all the carbon atoms on Earth in the biosphere, 1 in every 8 goes through a pteropod. And we're wiping them out because of ocean acidification. And they also cause, well, they are the feed of 70% of the feed supply for the Atlantic salmon. Did it make it in the Murdoch press? Nothing, not a single thing. So it is getting bad. Is it getting expensive? Done. What I get to? Oh, he wins. I was 2 minutes, two right. Seconds over.
Very close. That was.
Tim won. Big enough for you, Tim. Yeah, you were closer.
Thank you very much. One of the things I talk about is power. This thing has power.
Probably doesn't work. He didn't test it.
It's not conscious, but it does have it. Look at it. Thank you both for being so accommodating of the constraint. I think we can accept we have a problem. Tim, human-induced, big problem. Getting harder. Carl, we've always had climate change. It's not novel. We've been looking. We know enough. And it's going to be bad and expensive. I think we've got a fair amount of consensus between the two of men on the stage here. So we have a problem. We have what Nick Stern, prior to the Stern Review, in a paper on the economics of climate change, described as a complex intertemporal international collective action problem under uncertainty. Anyone who thinks that tackling a problem of that nature is easy, I think is probably deluding themselves. But we do have a human-induced problem. It is within the capacity of human beings to take decisions that can actually reduce the risks of that problem. That isn't so much to quote Al Gore, an inconvenient truth, although it may be inconvenient for some, but maybe we should look at it also as an enabling truth. It enables us to do things differently, maybe in the spirit of hope. We have another 2 5-minute sessions from Carl and Tim. I think in the interests of being fair, I think maybe Carl, you should go first. And what I want to know is what you believe Australia, not the world, what Australia needs to do to reduce the risks of this problem.
And in 3 and go. First thing we should do is stop exporting coal. Newcastle is the biggest coal exporting port in the entire known universe. This will have the advantage of increasing the price of coal and making it more economically unattractive. That's the first thing we should do. Just simply stop exporting coal, stop using coal. Second thing, we should start factoring in to some degree, ocean level rise, because it's going to get awfully expensive, awfully fast, to shift the 75% of the population who live in the fire-festering sores that we call cities in Australia. It's okay for the capital cities because they can afford to put up a seawall because they've got the tax base. By the way, none of this cost is going to be carried by the fossil fuel companies unless we make them. Think of the analogy of slavery. Slavery finished in the United Kingdom, in the United States. Who got compensation? The slaves? No, the slave owners. They got compensation, not the slaves. My heavens. And what we've got to do is realise that and change it around so that we've got to deal with this ocean level rise on a bigger level than we have been doing so far and actually start acknowledging it. So in Cairns right now, the designated area where everybody should gather in case of a disaster is in an area, a football field, which is underwater at high tide when there's a big storm with very low pressure. And the hospital's being built there. Sunshine Coast Hospital's being built only 2 metres above sea level. We've got to start thinking ahead. So first thing, stop cold. Second thing, ocean level rise. Third thing, war footing. Okay, we're in this stage where we cause global warming. Every day, a certain amount of heat comes from the sun, hits the Earth's atmosphere, goes up into the atmosphere, and instead of going out, hits the carbon dioxide and comes down. And we have measured this amount of heat coming down to the ground, both from satellites up there and on the ground. And the amount of heat coming down each day is equivalent to 400,000 Hiroshima bombs worth of heat each day. And it's increasing slowly. We have to go onto a war footing. On the 7th of December 1941, Pearl Harbor got bombed. Within 9 months, the number of motor vehicles made by the car companies in America for the domestic market was zero. And a typical case was that at the Dearborn Ford factory in Michigan. Within 3 years of Pearl Harbor getting bombed, they were making bombers. I'm not talking about a little bomb, I'm talking about this huge aeroplane with a crew of about 15 to 20, depending, and a whole bunch of gun turrets around and places for bombs and four engines, and they were pumping them out at the rate of one per hour. We need to go, we can go, onto a war footing. So stop selling coal, start planning in Australia for the ocean level rise, and go onto the war footing, which includes reduce the amount of carbon dioxide we produce to zero and then start sucking it out. We can get the situation of producing all of our electricity from renewables if we go onto a war footing within 10 years. That's 50% of the world's carbon dioxide. Transport, which is about 15%, we can go that by 15 years. We have to convert the aeroplanes, which are essential, onto running on hydrogen fuel. And then agriculture, which is another 15, 20, 25%, depending where you are, is harder because we're dealing with biology. Anything you do with biology is complicated and we start pulling that back. So we then reduce our carbon dioxide output way down and then we kick into sucking it back. And if you listen to the science show of 2 weeks ago, there's a wonderful report about how people have built these machines that can suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and stop that 5 to 8 metre ocean level rise we're getting by the end of the century if we include the positive feedback loops. So the number of machines that we would need would be 80 million. That's a huge number. How many motor vehicles do we make every year for the planet? 100 million. It's just simply going onto a war footing and reversing what we're doing with some leadership from the top. So I tell people like you and your kids to run for politics, to go into parliament. In some parts of the world, power comes out of the barrel of a gun. In Australia, it comes out of the parliament, and you can get into parliament with 77 votes. That's how good our politics are. So you should run, put things onto a war footing and start doing things yourself. I myself ran for politics and all I could afford was a 30-second advertisement on Sunday mornings after the abdominizer ads and the non-stick fry pans and before the born-again fundamentalist gun-toting Christians from Texas. Done! Oh, come on! I reckon I hit it on a nail. Plus or minus a second.
I think we'll give you a plus 1 second, because I was a little bit slow there.
Yeah, so, okay. Come on, Tim.
Not competitive. Yeah,
we're not competitive. We're singing off the same song sheet.
Carl, no. Thank you very much. Tim, I just remind everybody of the question. What Australia needs to do.
What Australia needs to do and what Australia can do are probably two different things, but let's talk about what we need to do and how we might do that. You haven't pressed the thing, right?
Oh, you ready? Are you?
Oh, you're such Tim, honesty.
Tim, are you ready? Are you ready?
I'm ready. Yeah.
Go.
Good, thank you. Look, we produce about 1.5% of global emissions, and that's long been regarded as an excuse for inaction. But if you look at the countries that produce carbon pollution, most of them produce less than 1.5%. The sceptics say, well, that's a rounding error, why should we bother? First thing is we've got to change our thinking and to realise that everyone has to work together to solve this problem. So Australia needs to do its bit. In terms of how we actually will move forward, there are two big areas that we need to work on. One of them is export of fossil fuels. So looking at gas and coal, I think it's fair to say that Australians don't want to see the Galilee coal basin opened for production. So that is going to be hard for government to do. It's going to take some civil action, and it's going to take a very clear message from the public that we don't want that in order for that to happen. If that's to happen without unfair consequence, we need to look very carefully at the social compact between us and the people who are going to be affected up in those areas of Queensland. It's not beyond our wit to do it. When we decided to stop logging the northeast Queensland rainforests, Senator Graham Richardson developed a package, structural adjustment package, that allowed all of those loggers who'd known nothing else for generations to move on to new industries. If we could do it then, we can do it now. So I think that's quite important. Second thing is we've got to shift our fossil fuel base here, so how we generate energy. That's already happening in Australia. Already wind and solar energy is at least cost competitive across the board and cheaper in many instances than gas or coal, particularly coal, which is much more expensive. And we are already having some impacts there. So you may have heard, for example, that AGL, the big energy company, the brownest of all of the energy companies in Australia, is going to get out of coal entirely by 2048. And that is good news, but we can hasten that. And I think 2048 is really the last gasp, because what they'll do is they'll stop investing in maintenance for their old plant. It's just what we saw in Hazelwood in Victoria. That was closed down by the regulators, who deemed the plant to be too dangerous without an upgrade, so it was closed. So we'll probably see that before. But we can all vote with our supplier is, make sure we pick a greener supplier, keep the pressure up. Let's hope we can get out of coal and electricity generation very quickly. We can also oppose coal seam methane development, because it's already either at a price parity or more expensive than wind and solar, and we don't need it as a backup fuel anymore. We can go to battery storage, we can go to snowy hydro for pump up and so forth. So we can balance the grid in different ways. That means we don't need to use fossil fuels. If I was speaking 5 years ago, I would have said we probably need gas as a transitional fuel. That's no longer the case. The situation, technological situation, has really changed. So they're two really, really big things we need to do. We also need to start investing in these carbon negative technologies, because they are going to be the future. If you're going to be building a building in 2040, 2050, a skyscraper, you're not going to be using the same sort of concrete we use today, because it produces too many carbon emissions. Those carbon negative concretes already exist. They're responsible for 5% of global emissions. New industries are going to be built there. Seaweed farming, you heard about the potential of it the early part of my talk. You know how many offshore seaweed farms we have in Australia? Zero, right? And yet research that's being done on seaweed farming shows, just as a few examples, that feed seaweed to sheep and cattle, you reduce methane emissions by 70% or more from that livestock. Really good thing. And also you get omega-3 fatty acids into the livestock, because it's not the fish that produce the omega-3, it's the algae that they eat. And so that's all good stuff too. You can use kelp for a whole lot of different things as well as sequestering it. We may even be able to save the Great Barrier Reef using kelp. If we can have kelp farms off the coast, pump up cold, nutrient-rich water from depth, bring it up to fertilise the kelp farms and let the cold water irrigate over the reef, we may give the reef some breathing space. We need to investigate all of that. It's not going to happen quickly, but we need to do the R&D now. We've got $1 billion innovation fund. We need a $10 billion innovation fund focused specifically on carbon negative technologies if we hope to make a difference and give our kids gainful employment into the future and start gaining part of this market. Beyond that, we need to reform our democracy. We all need to be heard more loudly. Representative democracy is failing us. We need to develop new systems that let us have a greater say in the political decisions that are made. I guess that's discussion for another day, Nick, but that's me. Thank you very much.
He wins.
Yeah, great. Two absolute professionals. The thing has power, but it has not been used. But thank you both very, very much for being so clear, so concise, and I think all of us in the room have got plenty to hang our questions off. And we now have over 25 minutes to throw to you to ask questions of our speakers. There's some structure and there are some rules, and I'm glad that I see hands coming up, but let me just give you some structure and some rules. Firstly, please ask questions. I do not want statements. I will stop people who start making statements. I want questions, and I want questions that are relevant to what everyone in this room has heard. That doesn't mean they have to be on the things we've heard directly, but they need to be related to those things. That is simply respectful. And please keep your questions short, because there's limited time, and that also is respectful. And we are at a writer's festival, so I need to share a quote, which I like, which is George Eliot on Adam Bede. She said of Adam Bede, "He was like a cock who thought the sun had come up to hear him crow." When you ask your question, keep this in mind. The lady just at the back.
Apart from becoming
Could you just say your name? I think that's important.
Rebecca?
Yeah.
Apart from becoming a parliamentarian, how can we mobilise to force government into action?
Well, Tim, you go first.
All right. And thank you, Nick, for that business about questions and relevance. I was in Lubbock, Texas some years ago. First question, hand went up, an old man said, "Do you think masturbation's a sin?" Anyway, so, but what can we do to...
We've still got 24 minutes, should people...
We need to really get involved. I'm a great believer in citizen juries. I think the more we can agitate to have direct consultation with people over key issues, the better. We saw a good example in South Australia recently around the nuclear waste issue, where the jury voted decisively against it, but government still wouldn't back away. So I think the more we can say to our representative members, your representation is inadequate. You need to hear from us about it, so in brief.
Carl?
Politicians vary enormously. One of the good things I learnt, besides a $250,000 debt of running for politics, was that they work really hard and that they are kind of like a cushion in that they tend to show the imprint of the last person who sat upon them. Separately from that again, some of them are good and some are just incredibly evil and you won't make any difference. Either way, you've got to make your voice heard should you choose not to run for politics, which I think is a mistake, and that in paper counts for a lot. So a paper letter is equal to about 1,000 emails. So write and then be heard and just keep on being heard and build up groups. Facebook works as well. Learn how to use the new hip technologies and just use them relentlessly over and over and be prepared to get some flack along the way.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that question. You absolutely kept the rules. I teach at Sydney University. I teach a course called Government 6316. It is called Policy Making Power and Politics. Should you wish to get further reading, see me afterwards. This lady here, and just so you can prepare, we'll have that lady afterwards. Could you say your name, please?
My name is Anne Long. I wondered if there are any, asking Tim, any operating kelp farms in the world and how effective they are.
Sure. Look, there are quite a large number of kelp farms around the world. So the Chinese have about 500 square kilometres of kelp farms in the Yellow Sea. South Korea has a blue zone, a blue carbon zone initiative that is encouraging kelp farms. The problem with the existing kelp farms is that, of course, all the kelp is a valuable product and is used, and the kelp isn't, the carbon isn't stored in the deep ocean. But there is growing interest now in mid-oceanic kelp farms, and we're just beginning to see the first inklings of the science that's required to make them work properly and to understand how effective they'll be. For example, a paper was published just about 4 weeks ago now, which established that even in existing kelp that grows naturally, about 40% of that kelp ends up in the deep ocean where the carbon is stored out of the climate system effectively. So we're now asking questions about where we need to site farms to put carbon into the system and so forth. But beyond all of those technical issues, there is the big problem of a carbon price, because if you want people to grow kelp and put it in the oceans, we need to pay. So we will need some sort of carbon price for that to happen.
Thank you, Tim. The lady in the centre.
Jill Stevenson. I just wonder if you could talk about batteries and how they're progressing.
Batteries. Sure. Well, Carl, you probably have a view on that too, I suspect.
But you're talking energy density per mass. And so to equal the energy in 1 litre, 1 kilogram of petrol, you used to need about 500 kilograms of lead acid battery. 1 to 500. As we're heading into the lithium batteries, we've been going down to 100, 1 to 100, 1 to about 50, 1 to about 45. As you end up with more energy in your battery, you are getting to the stage of where you've got as much energy as you have in petrol. And we have learned how to deal with petrol. We all drive around in cars powered by petrol or diesel, and we've learned the technology to handle it safely. We'll do the same thing with batteries. Our knowledge on batteries slowed enormously in the early 20th century, and only now is taking up. We're down around 20 to 1 with regard to petrol. We'll get to 1 to 1 in a couple of decades, just add the energy. Yeah, so we can do it.
Could I just add, I think that's absolutely right, but when you talk about storing energy for industrial scale uses, I don't think batteries are the first choice. Storing energy in thermal form, so either in liquid salts or in sand, looks like a very prospective option for those large scale users. And of course, storage as pump up hydro is the other possibility. So you can use, you know, your thermal means of doing it. You can use batteries, and that way you can use water, gravity. So there's a number of ways of.
And to follow on from that quickly, at the University of Melbourne, which is a perfectly good university, even if it's not the University of Sydney, they have something called Zero Carbon Australia. Download the documents. The 2 meg document took me 2 hours to read. The 10 meg document took me 10 hours. You can get all of Australia's electricity entirely from renewables within 10 years from 60% electricity with solar thermal. Not the stuff on your roof, read it up, and the remaining 40% from wind.
And that's such an interesting technology. You just concentrate the sun's energy, get 1,000 degrees C, you know, very, very high quality heat that can be used for a lot of purposes. You can actually break CO2 molecules apart using it.
Thank you very much. Lady with the nice red specs.
How important is it for us to think about the difficult thing of changing our own habits, for example, our eating habits, our overseas travel habits, our day-to-day things that we, as privileged people, do?
Could I just ask your name?
Oh, sorry. I'm Carolyn Lahovich.
Carolyn.
Look, I think it's a really important moral question. And some things, we're all in different positions, aren't we, really? You know, if you're a young student renting, you know, digs somewhere, you probably have difficulty raising the money to change your light globes, you know, knowing you're only going to be there a short time. So maybe social activism is better for you than, you know, investing in stuff. But if you're, you know, 60-something and you've got a house and you haven't got solar panels on it and you're driving a big gas guzzler, then obviously there's things you can do to improve your profile. In terms of travel, I mean, I do a lot of travel and I do offset, but I recognise the total inadequacy of it. As soon as an airline jumps up that's going to be using biofuels, you know, I'll be their customer, right? But at the moment, we don't have that option. So when I travel for work, which is mostly what I do, in fact, almost entirely what I do, you know, I've just got to face that reality. That's going to be the last sector to change. So my sense is, you know, cast about with where you might be most effective. I think for anyone, that social leadership is hugely important. You know, getting out there and being heard, in your family, in your school group, in wherever it is, that your community groups, is great. And there are organisations like the Climate Council, forgive me for pushing my own organisation, which do great things, which need public support. So, and if any of you are supporters of the Climate Council, could I just say thank you, because we are making a difference bit by bit.
With eating, you can go more vegetarian. So to make 1 kilogram of beef requires 15,000 kilograms of water, which is not lost. It's just that we can't have it now and it's going in the cycle. We have to wait for it to come around again. So as you go more to a vegetarian, vegan diet, your drain upon the planet is less. However, if you are a vegan and have vegan children, they will be stunted in height. It's just the way it is. Sorry. B12, go to it. Yeah, vegetarian heart. With travel, I do a fair bit of airline travel. The way around for the carbon emissions per kilometre is the same as going in a motor vehicle. But you're just doing a lot of kilometres, like 12,000 in one go, instead of over a year. The way around that is hydrogen. Compared to kerosene, which is what jet fuel is, hydrogen has 4 times the amount of energy per kilogram, but 1/4 of the energy per litre. Takes up a lot of volume. I drove a hydrogen car earlier this week. So what we do is we get our existing planes, like the Airbus 380, and put aside 10% of the passenger space for hydrogen fuel. And by the way, in the Hindenburg, it wasn't the hydrogen that burnt, it was the doping on the skin. So we can get around all of these. These are just simple technological problems that we can fix. Have we the will to do it?
Thank you, Carl. Lady just down here at the front.
Hi, my name's Kerry. If the science is definite and the economics is on par and getting better, what's your view? What is holding our government back? What are they afraid of? Is it simply the power of the fossil fuel lobby? Is it fear of loss of their own power? What is holding them back, in your view? Have they backed themselves into a corner? They just can't lose face by changing? What is holding them back?
Look, in the cynical moment, I kind of paraphrase it by saying I just don't pay enough to get heard. You know, so if you can pay lobbyists to be in the government's ear every day of the week, you get heard. You know, whereas I can't afford to do that. The problem is the existing fleet of assets, really, and the money that's already sunk. So Adani's a good case, you know. When that Carmichael mine was conceived of a decade ago, there was a pretty good business case, no environmental case, but a good business case for doing that. But now, the $1 billion later that they've sunk into it, the business case is looking wonky, it's looking harder, but people's pride and money and everything is now sunk into this project, which is looking dubious, like the Three Gorges Dam in China. You know, these things have a life of their own. Government finds it hard to regulate this stuff because of the reason I said. But it is all doable. We need to retire assets early. So Liddell Power Station up here in the Hunter Valley, 2,000 megawatts, going to be closed by 2022. Government could easily close that down early with a bit of a hand to AGL, a bit of an effort. It may not even take much money. But so we need to do that. And then, of course, make sure the transition's smooth, and that's the big role of government as well, making sure the net is up to it, making sure we've got the right incentives for the new energy technologies to go where they need to go, and so forth.
I would recommend reading the book Econobabble by Richard Dennis, DNNISS, and it will surprise you as to how much money there is in the system. Number two, on average, out of a gross domestic product of $1,000 billion, our government gives $137 billion as subsidies to companies overwhelmingly foreign-owned. $137 billion each year is given away to go to the Cayman Islands and go on a little holiday. So and thirdly, for each $1,000 you put in as a lobbyist to the re-election fund, you will, on average, get back $1 million. Put in $10,000, you get $10 million back in tax problems. As you mentioned economics, let me say the word hidden externalities. And so in America, 26,000 people, according to a Harvard study, get killed by air pollution every year. Did any single one of them get a check from the electricity coal stations to cover the cost of the funeral? In the Hunter Valley, I know people who can no longer use electric dryer, who have to use electric dryers because the coal dust goes on their clothes, and so they can't dry their clothes by sunlight. Do they get a check to cover that? No. China, one reason that China is going for the version of keeping the air clean is that the dirty air under the Huang, H-W-A-N-G, river policy, where 500 million people got cheaper coal or zero-cost coal to make the move into the north, what has that led to is a situation where 500 million people have lost 5 years of life expectancy. That is a huge economic cost to the Chinese government. So 5 years off their working life, plus another 5 years when they're crook, plus another 10 years when they're not working at full efficiency, that's 20 years, you're losing half of a lifetime of efficiency. So the Chinese government, with a centralised economy, is just saying, we're going to make the air cleaner because it'll make everything cheaper in the long run.
Kerry, excellent question. Straightforward, simple, direct question. I might just respond. As an academic, and also as someone who was engaged in the practice of helping and try to develop policy at the centre of government to reduce the risks of climate change, I would encourage you to do my courses. However, given that you may not find this appealing, I will just say one thing. It is very, very difficult for any government in any liberal democracy to impose a cost for a certain future benefit. Think about it. An extra cent on income tax hypothecated towards education. Many people will say, well, actually, I don't think it should be education. It should be health. It should be environment. It should be something else. But nonetheless, it's defined. The challenge in climate change, and there are many of them, but I just share one, is that one is imposing a cost for an uncertain future benefit. Because you may well reduce the risks in line with all of the data that we've had shared here by our eminent speakers, but unless the rest of the world does the same thing, we will not be reducing the risks of climate change. It is an enormous tension. I can also recommend other books that you might read, which are even more interesting on this subject. But thank you very much for that. We've had a fantastic contribution from one gender in the audience. And I think it's good. I will seek to balance that in a moment, but seeing as I am a man, they are men, I'm going for a woman with fair hair up here.
Thank you. My name's Pauline Kirby. I'm from Cronulla. And Tim, in particular, I was wondering if you'd like to comment on fisheries research. At Cronulla, we've seen the tragedy over the last few years of our Fisheries Research Institute of over 100 years closed for no apparent reason. The last director there, as it happened, was researching kelp. He may still be. But I just thought you might like to comment on the importance of this research in fisheries generally to climate change.
That closure of that station and the abolition of the marine reserve around that area, as I understand it happened, was an act of utter barbarism and stupidity that people should be held accountable for, because that was one of the most stupid things I've ever seen in my life. You know, to have that, have those marine reserves and the experiment they represent and the research going on for so long in that area, and then to get rid of it on the whim of it, anyway, I won't mention, it were just unspeakable.
Thank you. I think I want another woman, and then we'll go for a man. There's a woman there.
Here comes the microphone for you. And your name?
My name's Teresa. And Carl, could you talk more about those machines that you were talking about that suck the carbon emissions out of the atmosphere? And how do they work? How are they powered? And how can we get some?
Ah, there are many ways there. And you would need the mixture of the biology, the kelp, which runs itself. And you need these physical machines. I have downloaded the paper. It's in the Science Show of 1 week ago on the ABC with Ron Williams. I haven't read the paper, and therefore I don't know. I got a general description, but the number was amazingly small, 80 million. Sorry, I don't know, but I'm going to be looking it up and doing a story on that shortly. Sorry, I failed you.
I can give you a little tiny bit of extra. It's just they're called direct air capture machines. They use a resin to absorb the CO2. And then it needs to be heated to about 90 degrees C to release that CO2 and use it for something. The machine, about half the size of this auditorium here, would capture the same amount of CO2 as 1,000 hectares of forest. So they're quite efficient. The problem with them is, what do you do with that CO2 after you've captured it? Right, so you then have to turn it into something to store it. So people, I mean, I've held a mobile phone cover like Nick's here, made of atmospheric CO2. It's the most expensive mobile phone cover in the known universe, but it does actually, you can do it. So people are making chairs and so forth out of this captured CO2 as well. But we've got a long way to go before we get to the scale, 80 million of these machines that you'd require to make a difference to the climate problem. It's like planting trees, right? You've got to plant the area of Australia to take 1/10 of the current stream out. So these 80 million machines, it's the order of magnitude is very large. And then using that. So if we want to use it for plastics, for example, captured CO2, we'd need to double our use of plastic bags and make them all from CO2 in order to take out a single gigaton of carbon from the atmosphere.
Thanks. A man.
This fellow has been
red jumper.
Red jumper, yes, yes.
No, no, bald man with blue top with grey.
Andrew from DY, sorry. Why do you think it is that the focus of climate change culture is so much on government responsibility as opposed to personal responsibility?
When asked why they rob banks, various bank robbers would say that's where the money is. And why the governments should have the responsibility, because they're the one with the most power. Tim?
I'm not sure that there is a climate change culture. I mean, the people that I engage with are often entrepreneurs, frontline entrepreneurs who are involved in these new technologies and development of seaweed farms or direct air capture machines or whatever. And then there is activists who oppose things. You know, physically. There are others who do lobby government. You know, there's a number of groups like, anyway, that are around the place that support, argue for greater solar panel deployment and so forth. So I think it's a very diversified field. I think there is one subunit that looks at government, but there are many, many other options as well. And then there's many self-help groups. There's communities that buy their own solar panels, put them on the local school, whatever. There are lots of different approaches.
Any gender? This lady here with the white top with the black background.
My name's Caroline Pierce, and in the interests of trying to be a bit challenging, because you asked for that at the beginning, just want to ask a bit about consequences. So there was a map on, I think it was on the front of the Sydney Morning Herald earlier this week, that showed what the sea level rise would be, what Sydney would look like, and I can't remember how many millimetres of sea level rise it would be. And I looked and thought, oh my goodness, that doesn't look too bad. So, you know, I live in Manly, I was expecting to see Manly underwater, and not at all. So given that most people, when you look at that map, you think, well, I won't be affected, why would people be persuaded to actually do something?
Yeah, I think it's wrong to focus on one particular consequence like that. So sea level rise, I mean, you're quite right. If you look at some places like Deal, for example, on the coast of England, that's naturally subsiding and having some rising sea level, there's a group of people who used to have water views who've now lost them. Their buildings have fallen into the sea or been demolished. But the people are next row back, all of a sudden they're kind of happy, you know, they've got sea views. And as the sea starts eating them away, you know, they'll rent them cheap. So there's a person who's never had a sea view in their life getting temporarily lovely sea view at Deal, you know. Society does manage to cope with some of these things, you're quite right. But there's equity issues there because the people who once owned a house on the sea own nothing now. They have no land rights at all. Everything's gone. So for an individual, that can be a tragedy. For society as a whole, we cope. But you add, you know, sea level rise, the incidence of heat waves, destruction of the Great Barrier Reef, which is already, you know, 70% dead, you know, biodiversity impacts. And by the way, the Great Barrier Reef, $6 billion a year it brings to Australia, so it's a very big earner. And then think about the fact that climate change is not a destination, it's a process. So if we let it keep running, the sort of stuff that we'll see by 2100 is going to be small beer compared with 2150. And you'll have grandchildren around, possibly, or great-grandchildren at that time. So think about the small things we can do now, relatively small things that help avoid big consequences later, and I think you can build a compelling case for action.
Carl, did you want to respond?
Sea level, ocean level rise is more than just those people are going to be affected, but I'm okay. Because suddenly there's a rerouting of traffic. Suddenly there's a loss of massive infrastructure. The costs of ocean level rise of just a metre or two are just huge. And it's more than just, oh, look, the blue line has moved over to here. Suddenly everybody has to shift inland and they can't. And then you'll find that a place that was a thriving shopping hub at Manly isn't. And then suddenly everybody has to go inland. The flow-on consequences are huge. That's a whole another talk on for another time, though.
Thank you. We're coming towards the end of our hour. I think we have one more question. Please only put your hand up if you think that the question that you're going to ask will give the opportunity for either of these two gentlemen to say something which is a fine way to conclude the session.
Mr. Chairman, could I put in a plea for the gentleman in the red jumper who's had his hand up from the beginning and has...
Tim, I don't know.
He's fighting for the mic. He's got it.
All right. Sorry.
So my name's Warwick. How is it, do you think, that the United Kingdom has managed to reduce its emissions by 36% in the last 25 years while we in Australia have got them down by only 4%? What are they doing right?
Yeah. Well, it's they've done a number of things. Nick has been in the middle of this, you know, during his professional life. But you know,
it was all me.
Yeah, it was all me. Yeah. It's long term consistency. You know, bipartisan support, an authority that looks at the government and what it's doing, and has the ability to compel government to do things. So long, it's a long term program. If you've got a program that's chopping and changing all the time, and you know you've got a divided government and divided economic message. Then it's so much harder. So I think it is just consistency.
Carl, do you want to make a comment on the United Kingdom?
That's it. I didn't even know they dropped it that much. Good on them.
Yeah, well, we can look at the data afterwards, Warwick. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Carl. And thank you, everybody in the room this afternoon, for making this such, hopefully, a useful, a memorable and enjoyable session. And if we could just put our hands together to thank our speaker.